Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
And welcome to the Total Soccer Show. Not yet a new year Total Soccer Show. It's that time when you never really know what the date is. But to help me make sense of not the date, but the Bundesliga, is Manuel Veit. I will say hello to Manuel in a second. First, I should say I am Taylor Rockwell. Joining me today is Manuel Veit. Manuel, it's good to have you back on the show.
Yeah, it is good to be back. And you know what? It's been quite some time. I know you guys, or you have gone through quite a lot of things. And first of all, my condolences, because I haven't been able to say it on the show. I really want to say it on the show. And I was very, very lucky to meet Daryl a couple times. And, you know, first in that time in Düsseldorf, legendary time in Düsseldorf, I have to say, one of my favorite Bundesliga trips ever. And it was just so fantastic to hang out with you and Daryl. And the evening we spent in that bar in Düsseldorf, I don't think I will ever forget. And then, of course, the trip to New York, and I got to meet Daryl, and I feel very fortunate now that I did get to meet him. And he told me in Düsseldorf about what he was going through and his optimism at the time. And I thought that was something that really touched me, because I really thought, you know, he seemed so sure that he was going to beat it, and it made me very sad when I found out that he might not. And, of course, devastated me when I learned that he didn't. And yeah, I just want to reach out. I mean, first of all, you know, my condolences to you, but also to his family, to everyone in the community. I think he was just such a wonderful person. So I wanted to start the show with this before we go into the important Bundesliga things that are really not that important, aren't they?
Honestly, there have been those moments of like, I don't know, I can't get so mad about Man United not winning a game. Like, there are much bigger things at play in the world, but still, it's important to care about the things that you do care about, like Manchester United failing to win, but we're not going to talk about them. We can talk about Daryl a little bit more for a moment, because first off, like, I don't know if it's the pandemic that stretches everything out, or if it's just because it has been such a sort of turbulent time for me, but I do sort of forget that there are people like yourself who knew Daryl, met him on a number of occasions, spent a lot of time with him, who haven't yet had the opportunity to sort of talk about him. I should note Manuel did message me, I think, as soon as I like released that episode, and has just been a very supportive friend to both myself and Daryl. And I think Daryl, I should say, like, thought very highly of Manuel. I'm saying this to the audience, but also you, Manuel, that like what happens, I think, on the show sometimes is if I do an interview with somebody, like, It's not an official thing we would do, but it would just become like, oh yeah, Taylor's talking to Manuel. Like, Daryl doesn't really talk to Manuel. It happened with Adam Bells as well, where Daryl would only be the one to interview him, and I never did. And for a while, I was like, does he think there's a feud here? I don't like that. But like, people shouldn't mistake that, like, you all weren't on many episodes together, because every time I would do a show with you, he would send me 15 questions to ask you. And I think he really respected your knowledge. I think he also really respected your, like, healthy debate. Daryl was a person who, if he didn't agree with you, would kind of go back at you in a way that I didn't always do, because I was like, what's the point here? Daryl, I think, would try to get to the bottom of things. And I think you have that same mentality where it didn't really get heated. Voices never get raised. It would just be a sort of polite back and forth that was a foreign concept to me, schooled in the art of debate, of like fist banging on the table and yelling. I appreciated y'all's sort of civil conversations about differing perspectives.
It was, you know, you feel fortunate when you meet a person like that, right? And when you get spent time with them, and when they're gone, you appreciate it even more, I think, in some ways, that you had that time. And I think that's always, you know, they say that's like when people live on in people's memory, that's eternal life, right? And I think we're doing that in many ways, you're doing it in the show, and of course in the many ways that he has all left us with something, judging from the outpouring that has been on soccer Twitter, which is huge, he's had, the impact has been enormously positive. And so Yeah, I think that's always, as sad as the passing is, it is wonderful to see that someone like Daryl can have such an enormous, wonderful impact on people, and that's being cherished. And I think that is something that we need to take away in the end of the day, that that's at least positive behind. Mm-hmm. And that's really wonderful to see.
Yeah, and I think it's a thing that I try to keep in mind, because I do sort of err on the dramatic side and get caught up in moments. And I think there were times when I would message Daryl, like, can you believe this is happening? And he would do 3 minutes of research and respond with, like, well, it's happening because of this, and it's not that big of a deal, and this is the reason why. And I think that is a thing that I think I've said before on the show, but will continue to say, I would like to honor and keep in mind that yeah. The hot take, the fastest take, is not often the best take or the most useful take. So I think that's a thing that we will try to honor and continue to honor on the show. So I appreciate you saying that, but I also appreciate that I think tends to be your perspective with things. I don't hear you saying, this player's bad, this coach has to go. There's not a lot of like hard lines that I feel like you've drawn that you then can't sort of back up. Sometimes you get stuff wrong, but so does everybody. Yeah. If we go back and listen to the shows in which I've predicted some things that were laughable, I would probably hang my head in shame. So I appreciate your approach to sort of knowing what's going on, figuring out what's going on, and then talking about it. And that's why I enjoy talking about the Bundesliga and the Americans in the Bundesliga. Those are the two topics we're going to be looking at today. So transitioning us to that conversation, I'd like to start with Borussia Dortmund, because it has been a long time since you and I spoke. Things are different and the same. I think every time you've been on the show since we did that Germany trip, the conversation has inevitably featured some question along the lines of, is Lucien Favre the right person for Borussia Dortmund? I think you have long said no. I have long agreed with you. We finally have our answer that he was not. What do you think was the kind of biggest stumbling block for him at Borussia Dortmund?
I would say his personality.
Okay.
And I don't mean that in as negative a way as it sounds, because I think he's a great personality. I've been very fortunate to speak to him many times, and I really like him. I think he's a wonderful person. But being a wonderful person doesn't necessarily translate into you being the right person at a certain club, right? The personality that makes you nice in this context doesn't necessarily mean you're the right fit. Because like Jürgen Klopp is also a nice guy, but it's a very different personality, right? And I think that is really where I think Lucien Favre struggled the most. I mean, you hear stories like he would leave journalists baffled at press conferences with his long-winded, complicated answers in his Swiss French-German mix in a part of Germany where, right, in North Rhine-Westphalia. He would give speeches to the team with his back to the team while drawing up things on a board, sort of like a teacher, right, at a club that's driven by emotions. He had the most profound tactical knowledge that you can imagine, but he could not motivate his players to give 120% for 90 plus minutes. And I think those are the things that are 100% key to not just Dortmund, but the entire Ruhrpott in Germany. It's a very emotional part of the country. It's a very football is lived, right, in a very similar vein than it is in many places in the United Kingdom. And I don't think he struck that nerve for people there. And he was always kind of like this gray personality who was very nice, very knowledgeable, but sort of like a teacher, but he could just not reach the players and the fans. And I think that's where he ultimately failed.
So to your understanding then, if there's a substitute coming on, if he wants Gio Reyna to come in the 65th minute and perform a certain role, play really well, score a goal, what have you, was it that like when he was communicating his instructions, was it just a very monotone? Was it very academic that made it sort of difficult to get across? Like what do you think specifically in his delivery or the way he chose to communicate with the players that like kept him from fully having the impact I think he would have liked?
I think it's all very complicated. His way of communication is very complicated. If it leaves journalists baffled that have been in this job for many years, and some of them have high degrees. And I'm not saying that they're smarter than players. They just think differently, right? They school differently to comprehend. Footballers want a clear and concise message on how to play. And Mats Hummels, who was one of the most experienced players, he put it to the point when they lost 5-1 to Stuttgart. It's like, we're asked to do all these little things, to play in these channels and do like these movements and all that. And it works, it's great. But the problem is it doesn't always work. And when it doesn't, then we don't have the ability to hold on to the ball and protect the ball and protect our play. And that's, I think, because for a lot of these players that were playing, trying to play this sort of football, it was just too much and it was too overcomplicated. It would have been, you know, whenever Dortmund did get points in that last stretch in this first part of the Hinrunde in the Bundesliga, it was always through individual actions, whether it be that goal that Gio Reyna scored against Stuttgart, right? He catches, takes the ball, he does something that is probably not written on Favre's tactical board, and he just hammers the ball home. Or Moukoko's goal just recently, right? Granted, that's under Terzic, but it's still under the old coaching philosophy because it takes time for things to change. Or before that, before Haaland's injury, Haaland would rescue them with a four-goal performance. But that's all individual. That's not tactical. And that shows me that maybe his approach just wasn't direct enough. You have to give players clear and concise language and not overcoach them, right? That's, I think, the other thing. And I think he just took it just a bit too far in that regard.
I want to ask about the coaching vacancy. I want to stick with this for a moment because I'm wondering if Lucien Favre's inability to communicate with the players, him maybe being overly complicated in his requests for what they're doing, how much of that explains the sort of downturn in Jadon Sancho's form this season? Still getting minutes, still getting starts, not scoring goals. Why do you think that productivity has decreased, and how much of it is Lucien Favre just sort of not being the right manager for him in the right moment?
Jadon Sancho is an interesting one. We've talked quite a bit about it on our podcast, the Gegenpressing podcast, right? And
which is excellent, and people should listen to that because it is yeah, it is like this is, I would say, like the Cliff Notes Spark Notes version of that podcast. That podcast is the like 800-page manuscript for all things you need to know.
Yeah, and it's interesting because like we have this discussion a few times now this season, right? Because it's such an obvious one, and I know Chris has his opinions on it, and I have my opinions on it, and I mean, a lot of them are the same. And we know this whole transfer saga, and we know all the ins and outs, and what really happened between Manchester, Dortmund, and Jadon Sancho, or really what didn't happen, because there wasn't really much that happened. And I think it is a factor. It's a lot smaller of a factor than I think people make it to be. But I do think the transfer saga is a factor. But I also
you don't
think
like calling it a saga?
No, because it was over on August 10th.
It was a short saga.
Many times online, on your show, and in many other places. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. You know, I was told by people that were in charge of the negotiations or lack thereof that exactly what was going on. And that's why I was so confident after August 10th that nothing was happening and nothing did happen, right?
Yeah, it's like if the Odyssey sort of began with like Zeus saying like, yeah, no, you're not going home. And he was like, oh, okay. Yeah. And that was the end of it. It's like, no, saga over.
I still roll with eyes when you hear all these other versions. Yeah. And it's just no. There was a deadline on August 10th. There was no call made. Maybe Manchester United thought that they like could negotiate something, but there was never any approach made. So that's not a saga. Mm-hmm. You know, bidding wars, like going back and forth with offers. Those are saga. The player striking, and he didn't do any of that. Mm-hmm. He knew exactly what was going to happen, and he was fine with it, right? And the Dortmund were always really clear. So I don't think it's the transfer saga. I think something is happening. I think that he obviously has a fitness problem, and I think that's very much apparent. He's not having the sort of ability to outthink. His head moves faster than his legs at the moment, and it's very obviously when you watch it on the field, and that could have a number of reasons. I know that he is not, he like many of us, he feels the crunch of the pandemic because in the past, when he was unhappy, and there was many occasions where he was, Dortmund would put him on a plane and fly him home to Manchester or to England, right? And he could hang out with his mates. But COVID-19 means that's not a reality at the moment. And that's horrible for a young person, right? I mean, we have to remember this kid is 20, right? Not going to be able to go home on a whim and see the bodies. That's kind of sucks. And you know, that would weigh on you mentally. And you see it. And then you have to also just remember that he's 20.
Yeah.
Kids in that age will go through ups and downs. And his playing style, as fantastic as it is, opponents scout players. You know, players are made out of glass these days, and they will know what he can do. So they of course, there's much more focus on him. And then when the other parts around you are not moving quite so well, then, you know, it's an accumulation of things. And I think Jadon Sancho, it will make go click and it will come back. We will see it, right? But I think there's a lot of small things going on at the moment in his life that are just weighing down on him. And when you are 20 years old, that's just A-okay to be in that state.
That's a fair
answer.
That's
just my personal opinion. No, right? We shouldn't crunch those kids because it happens. It's been 13 games. That's not even that long.
No, it's not. But it is long enough for us to know, I think, as you've said, that there were lots of little things going wrong for Dortmund on and off the field. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way because businesses that grow grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
What do you think, or who do you think is most likely to replace Thomas Tuchel? That was another question I had, to replace Lucien Favre. And who do you think would do the best job? Who do you think is the best candidate, but who do you think maybe they'll end up hiring?
Oh boy. This is a good one. I think it will be Marco Rose is the favorite to get the job. I know that Marco Rose has an exit clause at Borussia Mönchengladbach that will make it possible for them. I do think he is a perfect fit. I do wonder if he is ready to move on quite yet because this is his second year. But I do think he's a great fit. Then there's Jesse Marsch. I know he's very high in the ranking within the Dortmund hierarchy as well as someone that they really value. And they value his character, right? All the things that we talked about Lucien Favre earlier, the things that the lack of passion, the whole like the gray mentality kind of thing that he oozes. Jesse Marsh doesn't have that, and you could really, you could imagine Jesse Marsh going there and bringing all that oomph that the club is missing at the moment. I think what they are worried about is the whole transition from the Austrian Bundesliga, where he arguably has done a fantastic job, where he has, I mean, Salzburg were only one game away each of the group stages to get out of the group stage. Very a bit unfortunate, I think, in both of those campaigns. But he has done a fantastic job year in and year out, replacing all these fantastic players that he has there with new fantastic players that he has been bringing up. Granted, with the help of a fantastic scouting system, right, and development system in his back. But they do wonder if he could make that step from Austria straight to one of the top clubs in the Bundesliga. Rose, who was in the same position in Jesse Marsh's and now, went to Gladbach first, had 2 years there, and then potentially is going to make the jump. It's easier, right? Another person that has been making its rounds is Julian Nagelsmann. I personally can't see that happening. It would surprise me for two reasons. A, Nagelsmann's personality and the Borussia Dortmund board would be a Tuchel 2.0. It would be causing problems all the time, because Nagelsmann, if he's unhappy or he doesn't disagree with you, he will tell you. I've had this experience myself at a press conference several times. He will have full-on discussions with you.
And so he's the definitive manager who doesn't want to be told. If you begin your question with, like, obviously, if they lose 5-0 and you say, obviously, the game didn't go the way you wanted, is he the one to interject to be like, no, actually, we had plans for how we would lose 5-0?
No, he would get hung up on a certain word that I use.
I see.
And then would explain to you what that word really means.
I see.
I got an economic lesson for the difference between being effective and efficient.
Aha. All right.
Mm-hmm. I now know the difference quite well, because I had Mr. Nagelsmann teach me. This is from, you know, I'm 34. So, you know, the age difference doesn't make me feel offended. But now have a 34-year-old Nagelsmann tell a 60-year-old Watzke the difference between effective and efficient. It's the reason why he didn't end up Bayern, for that very reason.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't want to have his... They didn't want to have that like school teacher mentality. They didn't like it. And in Leipzig, it works, right? Because it's almost like a think tank rather than a football club, right? They won personalities like that there.
Which one of Bayern liked him?
Hmm?
Wasn't it like one liked him, one didn't, between Uli Hoeneß and Rummenigge?
Rummenigge, I liked him. Hoeneß thought he was still too... Oh, no, I think it's the other way around. Hoeneß... thinks really highly of him, and Rummenigge didn't quite agree. I mean, I think it could still happen maybe 10, 15 years from now, but I think they just think that he is just too young at the moment. And I think there would be just too many clashes between the players and the players and the coach and the board and all that because of the age difference. But at Leipzig, that doesn't matter because, you know, he works in a laboratory there, because there is not that football club. Doesn't exist. The sporting director is his age. The CEO is in his mid-40s and comes from a different sport, so like has a totally different background. Oliver Minzlaff, who I think very highly of, and they like that kind of culture of active discussions in Leipzig, right? It's the Red Bull system is designed that way, but that would not work in Dortmund. And also, he comes from a Red Bull club, which the fans would just. It would be different for Marsh because it's a different league, but with Vicky, I'm straight from Leipzig, you know, fans don't often, but you get the gist of it.
Yeah.
And Marco Rose would also Red Bull coach, but before, so it would be also okay, right? As I said, fans don't always make sense. But I think that Nagelsmann, I think Dortmund are sort of eyeing him up, but I just can't see that fit. And I do think that Rose it's probably Rose's job to lose. Really his decision whether to take it or not. I just think it really comes down to him, and then it will depend on, you know, Dortmund will go from there.
So I think the thing that I find confusing about some of those names you've mentioned, Nagelsmann and Rosa, is that when I, like, my brain works in groupings, not saying this is the correct way to do it, but I think of the Bundesliga as being Bayern Munich in that top tier, and they're by themselves, mm-hmm. And then there's this kind of group underneath them of Leipzig, Dortmund, Gladbach, Leverkusen. So to hear that two of the clubs I just mentioned, their managers are linked with another one of those clubs' vacancy, like, it seems like more of a lateral move, I guess is what I'm asking. And I'm realizing though that, like, Dortmund probably have more money than Gladbach, probably have more appeal than Leipzig. But how much of a vertical move would that be for either of those two gentlemen to move from Leipzig for Nagelsmann or from Gladbach for Rosa?
Yeah, I don't think Dortmund are above all those other clubs.
Okay.
In stature and money and, you know, and it's changing because I think Leipzig are breaking into that. And I think we all know that Leipzig's goal is to be the number one. Mm-hmm. They want to win the Champions League. I mean, they came close already last season. And I think that's their goal. They want to be consistency in the top four in Europe. And they will get there eventually. They're just not doing it the Manchester City way by breaking FFP. I mean, sorry, sort of complying with FFP rules. You know, they're doing it slower because they have to, because the UEFA is keeping a much closer eye on them than they're doing on Manchester City. And therefore, the growth is much slower, but it's much more consistent. And you see the gap closing every year between it. I think it has closed to Dortmund, which is probably another reason why Nagelsmann doesn't want to go to Dortmund, because the trajectory is quite clear where Leipzig are going. You know, you give Leipzig another 5-6 years and they will be in the same category as Bayern. And that's because they will always make money, right? Because of who they own by and the structure and the way they are operating is just putting them into a very good spot. But at the moment, Dortmund are just behind Bayern. And that's, I think, what's frustrating a lot of people in the club hierarchy is the financial gap between Dortmund and the rest of the league is quite substantial. And the gap between Bayern and Dortmund is also, there's also a gap, but it's not as big as the gap between Dortmund and the rest of the league. And I think Dortmund are seeing the fact that they probably gambled away the last three German championships because they should have won at least one of those. You know, and Bayern gave them every single opportunity that Dortmund could take. They probably last year under Flick, that second half, Bayern were the best team in the world. I think it's hard to dispute that. And they probably wouldn't have won that one. But the year before that and the year before that, the door was as open as it ever could be. And they didn't walk through it. And, you know, that's something that really frustrates Borussia Dortmund, because like them walking through that door and winning the title maybe once or twice, gives the rest of the world a very different perspective on the Bundesliga and the league it is, but also changes the perspective on what Dortmund are as a club, right? Because right now everyone sees them, and someone who doesn't follow the Bundesliga closely thinks, oh yeah, they're just like Leverkusen, Gladbach and Leipzig. And fault them for that, but I don't fault them for that, because what have they won to show differently, right?
Yeah, I think that's what sticks out to me, is like they certainly have more name recognition. If I were revising my groups, it would be Bayern at top. Then there's like a second group with Dortmund and maybe Leipzig creeping in, and then there's others behind them. But I think it's the lack of silverware, the fact that they keep moving players on. It feels like there's not yet that consistency you need to reach that top level. They do have some players performing well, obviously, one of whom would be Gio Reyna. I wanted to ask you about him for a second, because things are obviously fairly bleak at Dortmund right now. Not bleak in terms of they're in the relegation zone. We'll talk about Schalke later. But just that maybe things have not gone according to plan. For Reyna, though, 10 starts, 3 goals, a decent kind of first half to the season. What have you made of his time this year? And have you seen development from him? Are there things you think he's doing better? Or are there things you think he still very much needs to work on?
Wonderful player. Wonderful player. I mean, he will be America's number 10. He will be the best player America will ever have produced. I'm saying that right now. You know, there's a huge hype on Christian Pulisic. He will overshadow anything that Christian Pulisic will ever do. He is incredible. When you watch him play and the things that he's doing on the field at his age, at a confidence level that is anything short of impressive, I don't think we have to realize he's what, 18 now, right? He's just turned 18 because he signed his first professional contract.
Right.
So that's the category that we're thinking in. And he's producing numbers that at a club that hasn't always done well at a remarkable consistent level. even when Dortmund are playing badly, he plays well. And I think that is something that I personally find remarkable. You know, there's a reason why someone like Erling Haaland calls him the American dream. You know, when great players love playing with other players, there's a reason for that. And yeah, I think in my opinion, he will be US men's national team number 10. Mm. And there won't even be a debate about it because it's not even close, right? I've seen both Pulisic and Reyna at the same age playing at Dortmund. And I think Reyna is, when we track players at Transfermarkt, I mean, I think he's already reaching levels that will put him into the top five in CONCACAF as an 18-year-old. And it's not going to stop anytime soon. You know, he's going to be at Alphonso Davies levels soon. And yeah, I think if he stays fit, and that's always the big one, right? It has to stay fit. And that's Pulisic's biggest problem. He just doesn't seem to be having the body that keeps you fit for that 100% season that you need to really reach the greatest level. Sort of kind of like an Arjen Robben kind of scenario, right? I think if Reyna stays fit, he's going to be one of the best number 10s in the world. And I absolutely 100% mean that.
I think you may have already answered this then, but I just wanted to clarify for a moment. Do you think any of what Reyna has done this season is manager dependent? Like, is there an argument that he is benefiting from a good relationship with Favre and that a new manager maybe doesn't play him regularly or doesn't start him? Or do you think it doesn't matter? All right.
Doesn't matter who manages Reyna. Same with Haaland. Doesn't matter. These players are so good. And the thing is, too, the infrastructure at Dortmund is so good to get the best out of players, right? And that's not head coach dependent. That's like, you look at the youth infrastructure that they have and the soccer now that they have, for example, that trains players, and it gets the best out of them. And it's like, it's a place where you can really focus on the sport specifically. And the fact that he's under a long-term contract and the right players around him and the people that he plays with, yeah, his development is going to go through the roof. And I think we're going to have him maybe in the Bundesliga for another 3-4 years. And then he's going to go to someone like really big. I mean, I'm talking really big. I'm not talking, you know, somewhere top four in the Premier League. I mean, like maybe like a Barcelona or Real Madrid or Bayern Munich, like one of those really big categories of clubs. And that's because that's the kind of player he's going to become. I think we're going to be blown away by the things that he will be doing in the next 10 years.
All right. You've made me very, very hyped about one American, so I appreciate that. Let's see if you can do the same about another one. Let's move to RB Leipzig for a moment. They've been in terrific form since late November, currently sit third in the table, obviously still alive in the Champions League. Tyler Adams has been getting minutes, mostly from the bench. In your opinion, is his lack of consistent starts more likely a result of any deficiencies in his game or things he's not doing that Nagelsmann wants him to be doing? Or is it more so that Kevin Campbell and Marcel Sabitzer are just incredibly important to that team?
I know that Julian Nagelsmann loves Tyler Adams. He calls him his quarterback, right? I think that, unfortunately, Tyler just like has some issues with fitness. And that's not always the athlete's fault, right? That's just sometimes it's genetics, you know. And that's unfortunately not much you can do about it. But I do know that Julian Nagelsmann is very high on Tyler Adams. And anyone who sees Tyler Adams play knows, you know, that I am very high on Tyler Adams. I've spoken to him many times, and I think he's one of the nicest personalities in football, period. It's one of the best interviews in the business because he's honest, and honesty is not something that you always get. And I think that is also something that Nagelsmann really likes, because Nagelsmann likes to give honest opinions, especially when you ask him not the smartest questions in a press conference. I learned this the hard way. But Tyler Adams is someone who I really always appreciate talking to, because you will ask him a question, even one that is slightly controversial, and he will give you an honest answer. And I think that's great, right? And he doesn't censor himself like many other athletes do. And I think that's a really wonderful thing. And he always makes time, you know, even when he's hurried and he has to race to the mix zone. If I ask him if he has just a few minutes, he'll say, yeah, okay, just a couple of answers. And then he will spend 10 minutes with you.
Yep.
Right. Who does that these days? And I think that's just a wonderful attribute. And I know, and I love watching him play. I think he has this ability to make players around him better. Because he has he's almost like Thiago-esque, right? With control on the ball and his ability to move on the ball, and his passing rate is just fantastic. But I think he just sometimes still gets betrayed by his body a little bit. But that is something that I think he will be able to control. So it's not his lack of minutes is not an underappreciation by Leipzig. It is really just the managing his playing time. And I know this season in particular, they have been very careful about this at Leipzig, more so than in other clubs, because of the volume of games that Leipzig have played. Remember, this is a team that reached the semifinal of the Champions League in August, right? Short break, and they went straight back into. They're facing exactly the same issues that Bayern Munich are facing, where they're dropping points because they're being overplayed. And you know, this is I think something where we have to really say, okay, well, he's only coming off the bench, or he's playing only half the game here. But matter of fact is he's also played like what 52 games in 40 weeks. That's a lot of football. So I think that's really what it comes down to.
Is there a chance at all that he needs maybe more Americans around him to do better things to stay fitter? And if so, do you see that happening anytime soon?
Well, there is Caden Clark coming.
There
right?
we go. Let's talk about that.
I'm really excited about this move because I think anyone who's seen Caden Clark play this year, we've spoken about one number 10 already. Let's talk about another one who's going to be a fantastic player if his trajectory holds, and I think it will, because he's a great player. Love watching play in MLS this year. Very excited that from what it sounds like, he's going to Leipzig next. I asked Tyler Adams about it, and apparently Tyler helped him out when he came visited Leipzig. So he's already been to Leipzig and then signed for New York Red Bulls afterwards. And apparently the contract is structured in a way that it has a clear pathway to Leipzig, which makes sense in a lot of ways, right?
Yes.
I did catch Caden Clark just before I went on my Christmas holiday. There's a piece out on Transfermarkt where we did every day. We did a talents calendar, you know, like an advance calendar. Mm-hmm. Every day a door open when we featured a talent, and we featured him on December 23rd, which is quite a prominent spot to get.
Yeah.
The 24th day was for the German talent that we use, right? And it's a German-based homepage, but our US talent was the 23rd. And I had a chance to interview Caden. I sent him some questions, and yeah, it's really interesting to hear back from him. And he seems like someone who has a really clear idea of what kind of player he wants to be and where he wants to go in his career. And I asked him, for example, because he ranks sixth amongst the most valuable U18 playmakers in the world. And I asked him about that, and he's like, well, why not be number one? Right. That's the kind of question, the kind of answer that you get from him. And I think he's going to be in 2022, I think, is when they want to bring him over to Leipzig. And I think it's going to be really nice to see him play there, because I think he would complement that team very well.
Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So we're excited about Tyler Adams. We just need him to stay fit. We're excited about Caden Clark moving there. One other recent arrival I wanted to ask about is Alexander Sorloth, who is not American, but is interesting to me. No goals so far in the league. Goals scored can sometimes be an unfair metric for a new arrival. How has he been with his new club?
Yeah, it's been a mixed bag. I guess the jump from the Super League in Turkey is a lot bigger than we thought. And because he scored bucket loads there, but wasn't that great at Crystal Palace, right? So, and the Bundesliga and Premier League are probably the two closest leagues in the world, the most comparable, right? Because the level is about the same. The style of football is very similar. It's only nuances that they play a little bit different. I would say that the lower teams in the Bundesliga have a more tactical approach, whereas the lower teams in the Premier League have a more physical approach. But the idea is generally the same. And he is struggling. I have an opinion on this. I think that Leipzig botched that signing because they brought in a type of striker where they really didn't know if he was going to replace Timo Werner. And obviously he's not a Timo Werner replacement because it's a very different type of player. And the fact that went out and signed Dominik Szoboszlai from Salzburg, right? And they have that ability to just go and pick teams from other Red Bull clubs and take them. That's the reality of the business. You can hate or love that, but that's just how it is, right? But they didn't sign another number nine, which makes me think that Nagelsmann is going to probably change the way he's going to play. Whether or not that is a positive for Sorloth, that really will depend on him. He will have to learn to play and what Nagelsmann's system is like. And it's really hard to learn. What was really telling for me was when Nagelsmann opted to play Forsberg as a number nine. And that shows you that, and Forsberg did really well playing as a number nine, right? Scored against Bayern. I believe he scored against Manchester United, if I'm not mistaken. And helped Leipzig eliminate Manchester United. Sorry about that, Tyler. I had to mention that.
I was just going to be quiet.
But it shows you that, you know, even though he's an expensive signing, he's not working out. So Nagelsmann will just go and he will take one of the other players and he will not take compromises for that, right? So for Sorloth, that means he will have to put in work because it has been a disappointment. And as you can say, okay, well, they didn't bring in another number nine. They signed another attacking midfielder instead. But that could also indicate that one of the other players that are playing in that attacking midfield, someone like Dani Olmo, right, or Emil Forsberg, who are quite happy to playing striker as well, could be converted to play that role instead because they're pretty good at it. So, it's going to be an interesting one. I think Sorloth will have to start going soon. Otherwise, Nagelsmann takes no prisoners. We'll just move on with a different system and different players, and he doesn't care about price tags.
We tweeted a little bit. You tweeted, I responded, about that Szoboszlai moved from Salzburg to Leipzig. My assertion was that that meant a fairly sizable door was going to be open for Brendan Aaronson. Yeah. I just wanted to ask you quickly if you would agree with that, basically. Does that sort of move for Szoboszlai open the opportunity for Brendan Aaronson to go in and get meaningful minutes fairly quickly on?
I knew that when Brendan Aaronson's deal was confirmed, I knew that meant Szoboszlai is going to leave. Mm-hmm. And it was really only a question of whether it was going to happen in January or in the summer. And I knew it was going to be to Leipzig. That's why I laughed when I saw tweets about Milan, Arsenal, all that kind of stuff. It was all funny. I thought it was hilarious. But because that pathway was clear. You know, it was everyone, you know, everyone in Germany knew that this is how it was going to go. But for me, it made sense. Brendan Aaronson was always going to be the player that was going to replace Dominik Szoboszlai, right? It makes so much sense. They're not exactly one player. Of course, in Germany and Austria, they mention all these other kids that Salzburg have that are all very good, like Karim Ademi, for example, right? He's a very, very young, talented player. There's someone like Berisha, for example, who has done really well, but also a very different type of player. It's Brendan Aaronson is supposed to fill that void. And he will have to do it soon because, like, obviously January, I think player registration in Europe starts January 2nd this year. So that's when he will come in, and the season is relentless this year, right? It keeps basically right away going. So for him, this is a massive opportunity to have this opportunity to do it right away and to play in the Europa League as well, right? Which was also the determining factor for Szoboszlai to leave in January rather than the summer. It was always going to be that if Salzburg managed to survive in the Champions League into the new year, then Szoboszlai was going to finish the year in Salzburg and then move to Leipzig in the summer. But because Leipzig survived in the Champions League and Salzburg didn't, they opted to make that change. Because now you can register players, right, that have already played for another club. They changed that rule.
Oh, right.
Right? So it made sense. They were basically, and this sounds so horrible, and a lot of football traditionalists will hate this, but that's just the reality of it now, right? They basically moved one of their prize assets from one club to another, right?
Yeah.
That's
the world we live in.
Yeah, that's how it is.
When you have like seven clubs named Red Bull or RB, I think that's probably the way it's always going to go. So Leipzig gaining a player, Salzburg gaining a player. Let's talk about Bayern Munich for a moment. Let's round out like the first 45 minutes of this show. I don't even know where we're at this point, but we should probably mention Bayern Munich pretty quickly because it seems likely that David Alaba will be playing for a new club this summer. Basically, what's happening there? Why has this happened? Because he felt like a player who would be there for long term. He'd be a Philipp Lahm or a Joshua Kimmich who would just be there forever. Now it does not seem like that's how it's going to go. So what's the latest? What's happened?
So I'm still not convinced he's actually going to leave.
Okay.
I mean, it is quite possible. Obviously, there has been a major breakdown in communication between the Alaba camp and Bayern Munich, which I personally think is very unfortunate because David Alaba is an institution there, right? He comes from the youth academy, joined Bayern Munich at 15 from Austria, Vienna, and he's the last player to emerge from the academy and play for the first team. Of course, now a bunch of new kids have made it. Musiala, Sirksi, and all these kids, you know, this year has been very good for the academy. But before that, Alaba was the last one. And to lose him is not something that Bayern wanted. But I think they're willing to let happen because it's more about proving a point to them. This is a club that's not fueled by an oligarch. It's a club that's not fueled by a major investor. It's not a club that's fueled by the state, right? Or a state. And it's not a club that can run a massive deficit and get bailed out by a state. You can put all the dots together and figure out which other clubs are meant by saying that. So they're saying this is our hard-earned money. And we're not going to give you 125 million euros of our hard-earned money over the next 5 years in an era of COVID-19. It's just not going to happen. It's just not realistic. We can't pay you 20 million a year and also give your agent another 25. It's just not the reality of the situation that the world is in at the moment. And that's really what it boils down to. And then there's a bunch of back and forth. Alaba's agent is Pini Sahavi. Google him. You find all sorts of nice things about him. Mm-hmm. He's also Robert Lewandowski's agent. And Bayern obviously arm wrestled Lewandowski into a deal that Lewandowski is probably very happy now, because if he hadn't stayed at Bayern, he'd probably never been the world's best footballer. But, you know, it's sort of, there has always been a kind of very difficult relationship between Sahavi and Bayern Munich. A lot of things said that are not so nice about each other, obviously, as well. Some questionable things, too. But I think it really comes down to the fact that Alaba's camp is asking for a lot of money. And I think we can all agree that right now, that kind of money is just not possible. And it will be really interesting to see. I mean, The Athletic ran an exclusive, I believe, on Alaba having contact with Real Madrid. And that's true. A lot of us know that Zinedine Zidane is a big fan of David Alaba, has phoned him many times. And there is a significant interest from Real Madrid to sign David Alaba. The reality is, though, Real Madrid falls in the category of a club with massive deficit that gets regularly bailed out by the state. But that's just not happening right now either, right? I don't know if Real Madrid can just shell 125 million euros on one player, even if he's without a contract. And that's where we're at. And that's why I'm not 100% convinced the final word is spoken on this yet.
If he were to leave, though, you mentioned some of the young players that have been getting minutes, have been coming through. One of those, I'm assuming, would be Chris Richards. How much do you think David Alaba leaving opens the door? Is Richards sort of poised to make that first team breakthrough, or do you still think he's got some time, maybe alone more likely?
Well, this is the chance now, right? COVID opens the doors for young players because there's five substitutions. I think he's been getting plenty of playing time, probably a lot more than we anticipated. Again, we're not at the halfway point of the season. We're in match day 13, right? Because it's all kind of odd this year because of scheduling. And I think he's actually getting good numbers of playing time for a 20-year-old defender, right? Defenders develop a little slower than attacking players because a final mistake by Ding usually means a goal against you, whereas an attacker making a mistake is a missed chance, which can be fixed. And that's why Jamal Musiala is getting so much more playing time than Chris Richards. The margins of errors are just much bigger. I like Chris Richards a lot. I think he is a player that deserves a chance at Bayern Munich, and I think he will get a chance at Bayern Munich. I think he will get more playing time, and it will be interesting to see what Bayern Munich are doing if they are going to lose not just David Alaba, but also Jerome Boateng, you know, who could also leave on a free deal. Although there has been talks now that they might extend that. Jerome Boateng, I think, has really resurrected his career under Flick, gone from a player who's been out to one who's been one of the most stable defenders. Really like him. But it's going to be interesting to see what is going to happen to those two players, right? And what Bayern are going to do in response of maybe those two players leaving, because they haven't been super happy with Niklas Süle either because of fitness issues. So that opens the door for young players, but it also probably means that they're going to do something in the summer as well and bring someone in. And that's going to be an interesting development. And I think there's ample of opportunities for young players right now to, not just for Chris Richards, there's a couple other ones in the academy that have already played for Bayern who are saying, okay, well, this is a chance now. It's probably never been easier for an academy player to get into the first team at Bayern than it is right now. And, you know, this is what you need to do. If you're Chris Richards, you have to take that opportunity and you have to grab it and you have to hang on to it and try to get those minutes and stick it out and show the decision makers at Bayern that you can be a long-term viable solution.
And it does feel like what Musiala is doing / trying to do, maybe at the expense of Leroy Sané. In Bayern's 2-1 win over Leverkusen, Sané comes on in the first half for an injured Kingsley Coman, then substituted in the second half. Raphael Honigstein, I want to start here. Raphael Honigstein used the word Hochstrafe, I think is what it was.
I used that too on the podcast. Yeah, it's what we call Hochstrafe.
What is this word? Talk us through it.
It's the biggest punishment. It's like the most severe punishment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we call it when you were brought on and then taken off again. That's called Höchststrafe. I think in this case, you know, Flick said it was tactical reasons. I think Sané played like he was under the weather, to be nice about it.
Yeah.
And he just hasn't been up to the standard that we expect from him. And I think that at Bayern Munich, things are a little bit different than in other clubs, that if you don't play well, you get taken off, especially under Hansi Flick. I don't think he takes any prisoners there. And I think Leroy Sané finds himself in a situation where he's been at a very good club with a very good reputation, and he's now gone to an elite club, and it's just a bit different. And I think he has to learn. And he's either going to learn quick or, you know, Bayern, it doesn't matter how much he costs. Look at Lucas Hernandez. He's the world's most expensive defender and lost his position to Alphonso Davies, right? And that can go very quickly there.
But to your point about him moving from Man City, like Pep Guardiola doesn't strike me as a person who puts up with a lot and is willing to like bend over backwards to indulge a player. It seems like things went pretty south pretty quickly there and stayed that way until he moved. Then he moves to Bayern, where it's expected that it will be the greener pasture. Everything will work better, and it doesn't seem to be. At what point is it maybe a problem with the player versus a problem with the situation of the player?
It's a very good question, and it's a debate that I know they had at Bayern Munich internally for many months. You know, when they discussed whether to go for Leroy Sané or Timo Werner or Kai Havertz or all three or just one of them, and then COVID struck and they got a very good deal for Leroy Sané. I mean, they offered, they were willing to pay 110 million euros last year and they got him for 50 million this year. You know, they got a very good deal on him, and that's ultimately, I think, what swayed them to go that route over all the other options that they had. But it's a very good question, because I know that internally there was debate about the people that Leroy Sané hangs out with, his agency, the fact that he switched agency halfway through the negotiations and complicated things, the fact that there was problems with Pep Guardiola. I spoke to a couple of people at Bayern that were very well informed about the situation, and they thought that that would actually be a deal breaker when it comes to Leroy Sané, and ultimately it didn't turn out to be one, but it showed you that, those discussions took place, right? And I think those people are getting vindicated a little bit at the moment, because they see the things that are happening with Leroy Sané, and they say, well, we always knew he would be difficult. We always knew he's a bit of a bad apple. But, you know, he tore his ACL, and that's a serious injury. And it's an injury that I sustained, an ACL injury myself. I know it's a very, very serious injury, and it is psychologically harder than the hardest part about it is coming back from it psychologically, trusting the joint again. It's not like when you sprain an ankle, you know, your knee is something that has to move in four different directions at high speed all the time. And an ACL injury is one of the most painful things that you will ever experience. And so it's in the back of your head. And I think that's something that we have to remember too, that A, he's come back from that. It's only really been a year since he started playing. And they always say it takes about as long to come back to the highest level that you were playing previously than the time that you were out before that, right? Neuer is a great example. He was out for 1 year, took an entire season to just reach his level, and now is one of the best players, keepers in the world again. And I think Leroy Sané is in that same category. We have to remember that he had a major injury. Then he moved clubs, then COVID happened. We're only on match day 13. There's a lot of games, and he's at Bayern Munich now. And I think when you look at all those things, I would just give it just a little bit more time.
Yeah, and then we go back to some of the conversations we had earlier about how young these players are and how you've got to give them a little bit of leeway. So maybe there are reasons to be optimistic about Leroy Sané turning it around and becoming that player that we know he could be. I have slightly less optimism about Werder Bremen. That's my transition to talking about them for a moment. And it's not even like necessarily, I don't mean it to be that negative. It's just, I have tried to watch them several times because I want to see what they're doing. I want to see how Josh Sargent is doing. And usually within 10 minutes, I'm sort of like, this is not the way I want to spend my free time. There are other games to watch. And it's a question that is sort of, it's an obvious one, but it's one I don't think you and I have discussed. Basically, what has happened to Werder Bremen? Because there was a time when they were good. They won the Bundesliga in the early 2000s. They went deep in the DFB Pokal, I think, as recently as like 2010, which is still 10 years ago, but it's still a club that for a while were competing. They had big names. They were doing big things. Why have they fallen off to such an extent? What would it take for them to have a resurgence?
Yeah.
I feel like this could be an entire like book. So I apologize. I often ask you questions that I think could be
the rise and fall of Werder Bremen.
Yeah, exactly. Make it into a three-parter.
Yeah, I think the one on the Roman Empire is, I think, 10, 1,000 pages each. But
let's not go that far. So let's not go that far.
I don't think we have time for that today. But it's really a mechanism of the football world having changed economically drastically in the last 20 years, and the fact that Bremen isn't a structurally strong city financially, right? It's a small market town.
No, I didn't know that. Right? Okay.
So it's not a huge, it's a small town in the shadow of Hamburg, right? Mm-hmm. In many ways. So Bremen have always kind of punched above their weight. Nowadays though, it's all about the corporate money that you have in your city. It's about selling the VIP boxes. It's about commercial money that comes in. And that's something that hurts Bremen quite a bit. It's a beautiful city, by the way. It's a small, it's a beautiful town. I had the chance to go to the stadium, and it's treated really well. It's a beautiful stadium too. It's a big stadium. The stadium is much bigger than you would expect for a city of that size. But that's just the reality. And I mean, we have situations like that in America, right? Buffalo is a great example of that. A typical small market town that punches above its weight in so many ways, right? Green Bay is another one, right? So sort of that's the kind of category that you have to think of when you think about Bremen. And I think that's really important to keep put in context. They were able to punch off above their weight for so many years because football was a different game. But now it's changed. Economic interests matter. Having big business supporting your club matters. Selling out your corporate boxes, selling out the 60 corporate boxes is worth more money than selling 10,000 standing tickets, right? And those are the things that define the strength of a club in so many ways, not just in Germany, but in every country in the world and every sport in the world. And I think that's really where Bremen have struggled. And that's why Werder are struggling, because it's just the financial backing isn't there. And they were able to punch above their weight because they would always finish in the top four. So they got that Champions League money coming in. But once they did not, then they tried to get back into that. And, you know, then it becomes the cycle of trying to catch up. And it just didn't happen for them. So without the corporate money, without the Champions League money, they just were not able to do it. And getting back into that top four level, look at Arsenal right now in the Premier League, right? Once you're out of that top four, it's really hard to get back in. And that's what pretty much happened to Werder Bremen.
So with their status being what it is, and Josh Sargent being a sort of key performer for them this season, how do you think he's viewed by other clubs in the Bundesliga? Like, if they're looking for a striker, do you think Josh Sargent fits the bill, or is he sort of getting the opportunities he is because of the sort of downfall of Werder Bremen?
I do think that he's at the right club at the moment because he's getting playing time. And Werder are a lot better this year than they were last year. Last year I was certain they would get relegated, and they did not. The miracle of the Weser has struck again, and they managed to get out of their situation. And at the last moment, pretty much, he's getting lots of minutes this year. And I know he's not scoring a lot of goals, but you have to see and watch the way he's playing and the way he's used. He's more of a target man rather than a striker at the moment. And I think in Bremen themselves, they see that very positively. We see it very positively. We just raised his market value at Transfermarkt, for example, right? Because we do see him very positively. We do see him as a player that has shown a lot of improvement this season. And sometimes that doesn't really reflect in the numbers. But, we know that interest in Josh Sargent is there. He's a 20-year-old striker who's playing regular numbers in one of the world's four best leagues. There's other teams in Germany, there's England as well that are interested. The question is, would Werder Bremen really be interested to sell him? Good question. We will probably find out in the summer.
All right. I have one more negative one, and then hopefully we can end on a positive. But I do want to ask about Schalke for a moment. Currently bottom of the table, lost 1-0 to fellow relegation candidates Arminia Bielefeld. Is there anything they can do in January to turn things around? Or maybe if not, then how hopeless do you think their situation is at present?
Oh, it's bad.
That's kind of what I figured. Really I kind of figured bad. This could be answered as yeah, they're probably getting relegated. We can move on.
I just can't see it. I just can't see it. It's interesting because that was literally our topic on our earlier show today. And
it's often a topic of will Lucien Favre be sacked and what's going on with Schalke are the two kind of reliable topics.
Schalke is kind of like watching the Titanic sink in slow motion. And we're at the point now where the lights are going out.
Yeah.
and then sooner or later it's going to break up and it's just going to sink. It's really bad. And it's really bad in so many ways that I don't think a lot of people at the club or people watching the Bundesliga understand yet. Because there's always this comparison to Hamburg, right? Or this giant of a club that's got relegated after many years of mismanagement. And now struggling in Bundesliga 2 and possibly can go up again this year, after years of finally sorting themselves out. What people don't understand, though, is the difference between Gelsenkirchen, where Schalke is, and Hamburg. Hamburg is a super rich city. It's together with Munich and Berlin. That's the top three cities in Germany. Economically, one of the financial powerhouses of Europe's. excuse my French, but there will always be an idiot that will put money into Hamburger SV, right? Gelsenkirchen is one of the most structurally weak cities in Germany. It's like the Detroit of Germany. It's the industry has moved on. There isn't much going on. It's a place where there isn't a lot of money. The only person that was willing to literally sink money into the club had to leave because of racism issues, Clemens Tönnies, right? There is no one, there isn't exactly people screaming, wanting to rescue this club from its financial demise. So if they go down with their 180 million euros debt, there's no one going to be there that says like, oh, here's my wallet. I'll rescue you. That's just not going to happen. So I often compare it to the situation that Kaiserslautern are in, right? Kaiserslautern, same situation, very weak structurally, city, very small. Once that club went down, they stayed down. And then they struggled for years to get into back into the Bundesliga, and they're now in the third division. And this, I hate to be Mr. Doom and Gloom, but that's the path Schalke are on right now. And, you know, we know this. No club is too big to fail. Look at Sunderland in the UK, right? Yeah. And that's actually, Sunderland is another great comparison to Schalke because, again, very similar city, right? Structurally weak. You know, yeah, they have found another billionaire that's willing to put money into it, but it's just that it's not like, you know, you're a club in London where the investors are just screaming to come in and like wanting to put money into it. It's not the same. And I think that's what worries me the most about Schalke. And I look at their squad right now, the few players that they have that are worth keeping, they will probably have to sell when they get relegated. And then the mass of players that they have, there's a huge bunch of very young, talented players, but we have no idea if they're going to survive in Bundesliga 2. And
is this to some extent the problem with 50 plus 1? That like Sunderland, if you buy that club, there's an idea that you put enough money in them, you can get back to the Premier League ideally, and then you're raking in the money. Whereas with Schalke, even if you put that money in, it's going to be difficult to have complete ownership, to have complete control, to do the things you want to do. So, like, does in this case 50 plus 1 potentially hold them back a little bit?
It probably does. I would say it does. Huh. But it's also Gelsenkirchen, you know.
So don't take a vacation there is what you're saying. Don't go to Gelsenkirchen for vacation.
I really don't like to be this frank about another city, but it's just not a nice place. You know, it's... you know how sometimes in old industrial cities have at least have some charm of old in the industry? They don't even have that. And I mean, it's no mistake that most of the players live in Düsseldorf, right? And that's hard. And I love about the city is that people that are there, they really care. And that's the horrible part, right? The people that are there, they really care. And that's, I think, what hurts for the fans, because you know, you as a person, you care about this club, you're making the effort, a city that has obvious problems, and to see your club being mismanaged like that, because you know, it means so much more for people there, right? And that's what pains me. But I saw it with Kaiserslautern, it was exactly the same thing, you know, the exact same problems, and they don't have the financial structure to stay alive. I just, you know, having it all seen before, it just strikes me how similar it is. And that's really worrying if you are a Schalke fan.
Well, then let's hope Schalke fans are okay listening to that. But let's try to end on a slightly happier note. I wanted to ask you which team has been more impressive for whatever reason. Stuttgart, currently seventh in the table, managed by American Pellegrino Matarazzo. That would be a fine answer. But I think Union Berlin, also having a stronger season than I think I would have expected. I don't know where you were on them. But which of those two teams do you think has been more impressive? I guess your answer could be they're both equally impressive if you want to go that route.
I would say that. I would say equally impressive. It's very hard to pick one because I did pick them both as the winners of this first part of the season.
Oh, cool. Then let's talk about why. Why are they both winners?
Yeah, because, I mean, sixth and seventh, you know, Union Berlin.
Yeah.
It's not supposed to be the big city club, Hertha, who are 14th. They're doing it their way.
I kind of forgot that they were that far ahead of them. Wow, yeah. Crazy. Okay, cool. Yeah.
With all the money that they spend, one of the biggest spenders in Europe, right, Hertha Berlin, and Union doing it the organic way and doing very well and playing really good football, you know, taking points off Bayern and Dortmund. despite not having fans in the stadium. I think that's been fantastic to watch. And they lost Max Kruse to a very serious injury as well, and they're still playing fantastic football. I think that is commendable. Stuttgart, I am extremely impressed by Pellegrino Matarazzo. And I screamed injustice when they did the FIFA Best Coaching Awards. First of all, when they gave it to Klopp rather than Flick. But also, what the heck is Marcelo Bielsa doing there? I'm sorry, but this is a manager who spent in the region of 200 million euros to get a big club like Leeds United back in the Premier League. And he's sitting 14th now. Pellegrino Matarazzo did the same thing with no money at Stuttgart, and he's 7th. So where is he in the vote?
I'm all for Americans getting more recognition for their coaching abilities. I mean, let's make that happen.
That's the power of the Premier League right there, in my opinion. You know, that a coach like Bielsa, who's done it with money, you know, he's basically a cheap Pep Guardiola. And I understand that Tactics Twitter is probably going to scream the heads off right now, but it's true. He spent the most, the sixth most money in the transfer window worldwide in the last summer. And that doesn't even include the money that he spent going into the league in the first place. So, yeah, great, good achievement. But Pellegrino Matarazzo spent no money, got into the Bundesliga, is playing wonderful football with a very young squad. You know, it's a joy to watch. Beat Borussia Dortmund 5-1. I bet Bielsa can't do that. And we're not talking about it enough on this continent. He's probably the best American coach on the planet at the moment. Just let that sink in a moment. Is there any other coach in any top four league in Europe that is in the top seven? I don't think so.
No.
And yet we're not talking about him. And that's a real shame because he's doing fantastic work.
So let's say people then listening to this podcast decide they're going to watch Stuttgart this weekend. Final question for you. Like, what should they be looking for? What's the style of soccer they're going to be tuning in for?
Oh, it's going to be fast. It's going to be direct. Lots of young players. Challenge anyone to say this name correct. Vaman Gituka. I practiced this so many times to get it right. Of course, he also goes by Silas, which is much easier to say. But he's a wonderful player. Koulibaly is another one. Nico Gonzalez, who might leave the club at some point. To hear some really big offers from other teams. But, you know, they convinced him to stay a little longer. It's a really fun club to watch, and the game against Borussia Dortmund was a great example. If they spot a weakness, then they will take it. They played really well against Bayern too. This is a game that they narrowly lost. Yeah, so this is a team that I think is not getting enough attention, including from us. Like, we didn't give them enough attention either. You know, it took us pretty much till now to actually give them some attention, and it's really a shame because I think it's a team that's fun to watch, and people should be paying more attention to what Pellegrino Matarazzo is doing right now in Stuttgart.
Well, they've got Leipzig this coming weekend. They're hosting them.
It's going to be a great game.
Yeah, so there we go. That's the game to watch, I think, in the Bundesliga this weekend. There are some other decent ones. Dortmund, Wolfsburg comes to mind. But yeah, okay. Let's go with Stuttgart, Leipzig, and next time we'll talk more about Matarazzo. But for now, Manuel, thank you so much for taking all the time to say the nice things about Daryl, but then also to say some nice things about some Bundesliga teams and some realistic things about some other Bundesliga teams. Not mean, just realistic.
It's always a pleasure to come on the show, and thank you so much for having me on.
My pleasure as well, listeners. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you again tomorrow.